I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Lauren, in the colonial room of the Drake Hotel in Oak Brook, Illinois, near Chicago, there's this soup.
It's not just any soup.
No, its price alone sets it apart. It costs around $1,900. That's $1,900 to take part in the Bookbinder's Soup experience.
Included in the very fancy ingredient list is a special liquor that is expensive on its own.
Why are you using such an expensive cognac? But that's really not the point. You know, they know that they've lost all the nuance in that cognac. It'd be like making a Bloody Mary with beluga vodka.
The Bookbinder Soup is a blast from the past that's aimed at satisfying the expectations of current and future diners.
And Chef Colleen Garcia, who is Director of Curriculum and Content Development for the, here we go, I'm going to show off my French now, the Auguste Escoffier School of Culinary Arts, joined the show to explain how it does that and to give us a real taste of the world of fine cuisine. And you just heard from Colleen and from Lauren, one of our producers. I'm your host, Mike Rogers. And this is Something Offbeat.
Garcia didn't start out as a chef. She actually started off as one of us, getting a journalism degree at the University of Nevada, Reno.
But her journey eventually took her to culinary school in Italy.
My whole class went over to Italy, so we were in kind of the Emilia-Romagna region is where the school was, in a little town called Colorno outside of Parma. And the school there was called Alma. And so we went and finished our program there. And then I was able to complete some stages as well, some little externships in Michelin star restaurants over in Italy before coming back to New York for my final exams.
So what was your reaction to hearing about this $1,900 bowl of soup?
It's so you can be seen ordering it. And so you can put it on TikTok and Instagram. And, you know, virtually everything that's amazing about that Louis XIII cognac that goes in there, that's probably its most expensive ingredient, that's going to be coming.
In Chicago, the Drake Hotel, it opened on New Year's Eve way back in 1920, and it was known as one of the world's first urban resorts.
People driving south on Lakeshore Drive in the city will find themselves looking right at the original hotel. It's always a cool sight. And then in 1962, the Oak Brook location was opened as an extension of that downtown hotel. According to its website, the Suburban Hotel has hosted King Charles III when he was the Prince of Wales, Frank Sinatra, and other high-profile guests.
This is a fancy place, it's safe to say. And this pricey soup experience that we're talking about today, it's offered at the hotel. It includes a snifter of brandy along with a personalized cooking lesson from executive chef Ezequiel Dominguez on how to prepare the soup.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
But actually, you know what that article missed that I thought was funny, and what I saw a couple articles referencing this dish is a couple articles said it cost, was it $1,893? It's actually $1,863 if you go to the hotel's website. And the reason that's important is it's supposed to be a nod to the year the soup was created by Samuel Bookbinder. So like I said, this is PR driving the kitchens, saying you need to reverse engineer a dish to make it cost exactly $1,863. So let's throw as much expensive stuff as we can into it. But, you know, even if you break down the price of the caviar or the cognac, you're still coming nowhere near that price point.
What are the other ingredients in Bookbinder's soup?
So from what I understand, it's a kind of a tomato-based soup that, you know, I know it has like celery and as a very vegetal base. And then traditionally when it was first made, it was supposed to be made with snapping turtle. So at some point that turned into red snapper, I think because turtle just kind of fell out of vogue. People don't like to hear that there's turtle in their soup. So they started using red snapper. And then in the case of this particular soup, they're saying that they fly the red snapper in from the Gulf of Mexico. You know, that's why you have to order it 2 weeks in advance. Which, to be perfectly honest, doesn't impress me. You're in Chicago. You're probably flying your fish from somewhere else anyway. And even at the outside top charge of what you're going to pay per pound for red snapper, you're talking $40-$50 at wholesale. But anyway, so you've got that. You've got this caviar, right? This expensive caviar that, at least from what I could tell in the photos of the soup, it looks like a pretty small amount of caviar. So you've got, you know, maybe $30, if I'm being generous, of caviar in there. And then you've got, of course, that Louis XIII cognac in there as well that takes the place of the traditional sherry, which is you pour it on top as kind of that finishing nutty flavor to balance the heaviness of the dish. And so still, if you all those things together, you're not even approaching $1,000, let alone 1863. But it's not really the point of the dish, I guess.
I was going to say you might not even be approaching 100 or 200. I mean, the cost of the ingredients is way less than what they're charging for it.
Sure it is. Yeah. And even the gold flakes, it's garnished with gold flake as well. But gold flake is not particularly expensive, nor is it, you know, that astonishing to see in food anymore. It's kind of a common thing, especially in desserts.
That was my next question, because that was the one that I was also thinking of, was the various desserts with the shaved gold on them. Is that real gold?
Yeah, it's real. It's edible gold. Very, very paper thin edible gold.
Isn't that an oxymoron? Edible gold. Gold is a heavy metal. You're not supposed to eat it.
You're going to find a lot of oxymorons when you see dishes like this getting the culinary atmosphere, I think.
How did we get to this point? Are there just too many people out there who have too much money? They don't know where to spend it all?
There's always been those people, right? So there's always going to be the dish that, you know, usually we see this in wine a lot, wine and liquor. So you see that Louis XIII cognac, you have it sitting on the bar behind you, but it's not necessarily something that, you know, anyone's going to order on a regular basis, but you want to have it on the shelf, right? You want people to see it. Traditionally, we've always had these expensive wow ingredients. You could have, you know, Kobe beef on your menu, like a really nice Wagyu, something like that. But how we got to this point, where we're kind of reverse engineering dishes to meet price points that represent the year it was created and that whole kind of cutesy PR stunt, is I think social media. It's really kind of done a number in how the public perceives dining out.
Social media plays into this quite a bit, doesn't it? I mean, from people taking pictures of their meals and posting it, having access to the menu of every restaurant, you know, in the world, just about. How has social media fed into this trend of ridiculously expensive dishes?
So social media has done a lot to kind of change dining and culinary arts, but it's sort of a loaded question because it hasn't done just any one single thing, right? So some context here. I'm on the older side of the millennial generation. I was born in the mid 80s. The iPhone came out when I was a freshman in college. So I'm, you know, part of that little specific number of years that are known as the lucky ones. We got to experience life as somewhat fully formed adults before all of this happened. And then we've seen everything after. So I have sort of, I guess, a biased view of this. But that being said, you could probably successfully argue that social media has done a lot to open people up to dishes and restaurants and entire food cultures that they wouldn't have otherwise experienced. And that's a really positive thing. But I think it's also done us a huge disservice because it's taken the experience of having reverence and appreciation for something and turned it inward. And what I mean by that is social media is almost a misnomer, right? There's nothing really social about it anymore. It's just all about yourself.
While I have definitely taken photos of my food, I'm usually pretty excited about eating, too excited to eat to actually wait to take photos. And back when I was a waitress, it would become this stressful little game of trying to put down plates without getting my arm in an Instagram shot. So I would get a little bit annoyed about it.
That's funny. I'm guilty too. I take pictures. As a matter of fact, and I'm looking at my phone right now. I've got a whole album, a whole food album of some of my favorite meals over the years. How did it get to this?
It's nice to look back and remember them though, especially when you're hungry.
You know, the consequence of spending so many hours on self-promotion and branding and cultivating this impression that you want to project and just thinking so intently about yourself has given everyone main character syndrome. And I think we're seeing that turn into something ugly when it comes to dining.
I did some research and found out that more and more people are actually relying on social media to determine which restaurants they even go to. Survey results conducted last year found that nearly 60% of adults ages 18 to 26 believe social media is the best way to judge a restaurant.
That's interesting because I don't generally look at the reviews when it comes. I look at reviews on just about everything else, but for some reason I don't with restaurants. I rely more on word of mouth and just driving by and seeing someplace that looks interesting.
I'm kind of the same.
What generally is the reaction in the kitchen when the marketing people come up with something like this? Is there a lot of eye rolling?
I'm sure there's always going to be, right? We're kind of a smarmy bunch in culinary. But I mean, my hope is that it's at least somewhat positive. We're all in it for the same thing, which is guest experience, right? We all came into the service industry hoping to provide guests with a beautiful experience or an interesting experience, one they can tell their friends about. It may not be the primary purpose of most of what we do as chefs. You know, we really like to focus on the cuisine itself and making it as good as possible. But, you know, if the hotel or the general manager, the restaurant owner, whoever it is, comes and says, we need to do this to drive interest, then yeah, you want to do it. You want to drive interest in your restaurant.
Which ones of these expensive ingredients to you are worth the hype? Which ones do you see in a dish on a menu and say, oh man, I know it's going to cost a lot, but I got to have that.
So this is probably my bias speaking because I went to culinary school in Italy. But for me, the ingredients that are always going to be worth the cost are the ones that are really high quality representations of the region. So the Italians are masters of regionality. Nobody does it better. Sorry, France, but it's just true. So really, when you take things like a good Barolo wine, for instance, or, you know, the white truffles when they're in season in central Italy and like Umbria, there's a cheese called Caciocavallo that's pretty high priced for a cheese compared to other cheeses. But again, it's a perfect representation of that region's particular cheese. You know, a good aged balsamic from Modena, prosciutto di Parma, obviously, like, you know, you get into that Parma region where I went to school. All of those ingredients, you know, really, they're either marked with DOP in the case of food ingredients or DOCG in the case of the high quality wines. And those are actually legal markers that indicate that they are tried and true from the region that they say they're from, and sometimes from a specific sub-region in the case of DOCG. So you're in for a really excellent representation of the region when you eat products like that. And even if they're not as expensive as, you know, $1,800, when compared to, you compare a slice of prosciutto di Parma to a slice of regular ham, that's quite a markup, right? There is a big difference there.
Does regionalizing an item like that drive sales? I was in Paris recently and I had a dish that had Tuscan chestnut honey sauce. And I looked at it and I thought, well, you don't really need to mention that it's from Tuscany, but I, you know, that might convince people to get it.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe, especially if you're in France and they're advertising Tuscany, then maybe it is to drive sales. But I think traditionally it's just people that are proud of the food in the area that represents them. You know, Italy's got a long history before it ever became a unified country. That happened in pretty recent history. Before that, it was divided up into various principalities. So they're very, very protective of that regional identity. It kind of reminds me of my first night. So when my class got to Italy, we're all jet lagged and exhausted. The first night we got there, we were driven out to, they just said, we're going to dinner. So we were kind of expecting to go to a restaurant somewhere in the city. We're driven several kilometers outside the city. As I found out later, all of the good restaurants are going to be outside the main cities in Italy. And we end up at this little farmhouse in the middle of nowhere. And they just start bringing out platters of prosciutto di Parma and gnocco fritto, which is this like Italian fry bread. It's kind of like a sopapilla, if you're familiar, but it's not sweet. So it's this warm, like fresh fried bread. And you just sit there and you stuff the prosciutto in and you eat it. And your whole world just dissolves into bliss around you. It's absolutely incredibly delicious.
You're killing me. That sounds so good.
It's so good.
Tell me this. What's the most expensive meal that you have ever prepared? As a chef in a restaurant?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I worked for the Ritz-Carlton for a number of years, both in restaurants and as a banquet chef at the Ritz in Denver. And so I've had my hands on some really high quality ingredients, you know. So you're talking about things like foie gras, for instance, are always going to be expensive. I had the opportunity to cook a very nice cut of Wagyu. So Kobe beef, actually. So all Kobe is Wagyu, not all Wagyu is Kobe. So I got to cook some Kobe beef that was probably the most expensive cut of meat I've ever set my hands on. And then when I did, I was on what we call task force. I was helping out at the Ritz-Carlton in Naples, and the guys there let me try my hand at cleaning some of the stone crab claws. So I don't know if you're familiar with stone crab. Is very, very specifically seasonal in Florida, right? And so this, you're talking about crab claws that are going to cost 80 plus a pound. They get their name from the fact that the shell is just like stone and it's going to shatter if you don't cut it correctly. So there was a very specific way to try to do this. And as they're very graciously letting me learn how to do it, and I'm breaking them, and I'm like, I don't want to touch any more of these lest I ruin $160 worth of food.
So last month, I wrote an article about a pineapple selling for $400. That one's called the Ruby Glow. And a few years ago, I also wrote about a $72 fried rice that became a complicated menu item for a San Francisco restaurant. In your years of reporting, has there ever been an expensive food item that blew your mind?
Yeah, and we've actually talked about the shave gold that you see on some desserts, and that's always kind of freaked me out a little bit. I just don't know whether I would eat a piece of metal with my dessert, even if it is shaved gold. I did a story once about a burger. It was a hamburger that was a couple of $1,000 at some restaurant in New York, but it was, of course, it was Kobe beef. And then they, like we've been talking about, they put every expensive item that they could think of on it just to get the price up and get a little publicity.
I agree about the gold. It just doesn't sound like it would taste good. And then Escoffier published a list of the 10 most expensive ingredients last year. Now, I apologize to everybody. I probably won't pronounce everything on this list perfectly, but I'm going to try. It includes Kobe beef, which you mentioned, white truffles, beluga caviar, saffron, matsutake mushrooms, Kobe luwak coffee, Iberico ham, Dansuke watermelon, bluefin tuna, and ruby Roman grapes. Avocados, which we talked about last week, weren't on the list. Out of all of those 10 ingredients, is there one that you think would be worth paying for?
Honestly, a lot of those would scare me. I don't know if I'd want to eat some of them, let alone pay $1,000 right. For the privilege. I'd try those mushrooms, matsutake mushrooms. The watermelon sounds good. And, you know, the Kopi Luwak coffee, you know what that is. That is, I think it's in East Asia. The coffee beans are eaten by these kind of monkey-like creatures called civets, and then they poop them out, and they pick the coffee beans out of their poop and brew them. So that would be that would be a hard pass from me.
Yeah, that's not something that's on my bucket list, I got to admit.
So when you're a chef, and this kind of answers my next question, when you're handling ingredients like that, your hands start shaking, you start sweating a little bit, you get a little nervous.
You do. But, you know, we've got to learn, right? I remember it was a big point of pride for me. I was working in a little French bistro at this casino in Reno. And the chef finally, for the first time, I had foie gras on my station. I cooked the foie gras, but I wasn't allowed to cut the lobe, right? To, you know, take the lobe apart and cut it and slice it. Because if you mess that up, there goes a very expensive ingredient. You can't put it back together. So I remember the day that the chef allowed me with heavy supervision to break down my first foie gras lobe. And that was a very wonderful day for me as a young cook.
I read on your bio, your favorite dish is risotto. Is that right?
That's right. It's actually a big fight in my house. My husband is a chef as well, but he was trained in the United States. He went to culinary school in Baton Rouge. And so there's like kind of this battle between, it seems, Italian trained chefs and American trained chefs on the proper way to cook risotto. Uh-huh. I actually had one of my first chefs when I started working for the Ritz-Carlton. I was at the Ritz in Lake Tahoe, and the head chef of the restaurant laughed at me because, you know, I was making risotto and I got out a saute pan, right? You want all the surface area you can get for that nice even absorption of the liquid and even evaporation. And he literally laughed in my face and was like, look at this girl over here making it with a saute pan. You're supposed to use a saucepan. And I was like, no, you don't crowd the risotto.
What expensive ingredients would you put in risotto if you could?
So, I mean, one of the most expensive ingredients in the world already traditionally goes in risotto. If you go to Milan, the risotto milanese, or as the children call it, risotto giallo, because it's got this bright kind of yellow color, it comes from saffron. So by weight, saffron is the most expensive spice in the world, right? And also it has to do with the fact of how it's harvested. There's only three little threads per flower. And so, you know, you're talking about $5,000 a pound once it's harvested. Now, granted, you need a tiny little bit of saffron to really get the proper color and flavor into the dish. But there's one example of something that traditionally the Italians figured it out centuries ago. It needs no improvement. And then I would say morel mushrooms. anytime you can get that just exquisite mushroom umami and use morel in a risotto, that's a singular note ingredient that doesn't need any muss or fuss, no additional seasonings. It's just beautiful.
You ever look at some of these ingredients and think to yourself, who was the first person? Who was the first person who pulled three little threads out of a flower and said, I think I'll eat these?
Yep. Exactly. I think sometimes about certain seafoods I see. I want to know who grabbed an urchin and was like, this looks tasty.
Or a truffle. I'm going to dig this out of the dirt and slice this up.
Yeah, and wrestle it away from the pig that found it.
I'm Mike Rogers, and thanks so much for listening to Something Offbeat. This episode, written and produced by Lauren Berry and Chris Blake. That audio editing by Chris Blake and original music by Myron Kaplan. And I keep listening. Subscribe to us on the Odyssey app, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have your own offbeat story that you think we should cover, let us know about it. Send it to us at somethingoffbeat@audacy.com.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.